Well, floating format tonight. We've got two special hours with the Teacher of the Year in the state of New York, John Taylor Gatto, back on Coast to Coast. It's been almost 5 years since John was last on with us. He's going to talk about, are they dumbing us down, weapons of mass instruction? Then a little surprise for you later on in the program tonight as well. Back in a moment with John Taylor Gatto on Coast to Coast AM. He's back on Coast to Coast now. John Taylor Gatto taught for 30 years in public schools before resigning from school teaching. The Wall Street Journal named him Teacher of the Year in New York State that same year. Since then, he's been a tireless advocate for school reform, traveling over 3 million miles to lecture on the subject. His previous book, Dumbing Us Down, sold over 100,000 copies. Brand new work now, Weapons of Mass Instruction, causing an even bigger stir. Here is John Taylor Gatto. Hey, John, welcome back.
Hey, it's a real pleasure to be with you.
You too, my friend. Gosh, you were on so long ago. By the time you came back, I should have gotten a PhD by now. How have you been? You're putting on some miles these days, huh?
I've been traveling all over the world. I did a speaking tour in Australia and one in Hungary last year, and I'm going to South Africa soon to do 5 cities there. Been to South America and, golly, all over the place. So I think the world is waking up to the fact that we've gone through a kind of surreal nightmare with forced schooling for about one century, not really longer than that.
John, I've got to tell you, the work you've done over the years, absolutely riveting. And the fact that you would think now that government is deliberately trying to dumb down the school system is frightening that they would do this. Tell me how you got to believe that, and then let's talk about why you think it's true.
Well, I had the good fortune to grow up during the Second World War in an obscure part of the United States. It was a little coal mining town about 40 miles from Pittsburgh. So without being able to compare it to anything else, I was put through a curriculum, which I guarantee you, these in a coal mining town, mind you, that you'd have to go to Harvard to one of the seminar classes to get. So when I went to New York City when I was about 20 years old, I said, this is the big time. I'm really going to see sophisticated thinking at work. Instead, I temporarily substitute taught in an eighth grade class, and it was about on a third grade level for Monongahela, Pennsylvania. Now, I scratched my head and I thought, like any other reasonable person, it's just this particular school, somehow or other. The stupid virus has come in here.
Right.
But gradually, as I substitute taught around the city for about a year and a half, what I discovered was it was everywhere, as if some template had been laid down, some program that parents weren't allowed in on. So let me give you some specifics, because I think your listeners will find this interesting. In seventh grade, in this coal mining town, Monongahela, we were reading Julius Caesar's Gallic Wars. And in ninth grade, we got the choice of whether to read it in Latin or not. I happened to have chosen to read it in Latin. It wasn't very difficult. And the reason given for reading it wasn't that we could be hoity-toity about ancient literature. It was taught to coal miners' kids as the best workshop in how to divide and conquer a superior force by setting the superior force, in this case the Gauls, against one another, so that a very small number of Romans were able to conquer a huge territory, outnumbered 50-1, not because they were braver or better fighters, but because they understood this principle. Now, as soon as you put it in that light, it would seem to me that anybody would want their kid to see what Caesar's Gallic Wars is all about. We've read Marcus Aurelius's Meditations.
Absolutely.
Now, that sounds very abstract.
I remember his name from the Gladiator movie, right?
Well, he was the father of that rotten guy in the Gladiator.
Joaquin Phoenix played that part, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
But Aurelius, if you step back from the book and say, I'm going to hear the inner thoughts of the most powerful man on the planet and the wealthiest man on the planet. So when he says that nothing you can buy is worth having, that happiness and success are all a matter of mastering yourself and understanding what really matters, this is big-time stuff, especially for a kid on the threshold of, making a lot of money, a little money, or, no money at all. And it contradicts, here's the richest man in the world, contradicting everything we heard in the 50s as the guy who gets the most marbles wins the game. Once it's pitched that way, anybody would want their kid to at least have the choice of being able to think in an ambitious fashion or in a philosophic fashion, the way Aurelius did. And on, we read classic after classic in uncut versions. And I'm talking 1945, 46, 47, in a little coal mining town on a river.
John, how do we compare to educational systems in other countries? Are we still slipping? I've always heard that.
Oh, man. Take this as probably the banner that ought to be waved in front of every school. In China, I've been invited to speak over the last 3 years, 6 times in China, and I keep my eyes open. And if I tell you that I have never run into a Chinese in China who doesn't speak English, many of them idiomatically because they pick it up from the Internet, and blogs and stuff like that, 300 million Chinese speak English. And I would say that never in my life have I encountered, I know there must be Americans who speak Chinese, but very, very few. I have not met one of those people. And I know a number of Chinese Americans as friends. They don't even speak Chinese. Now, is it a sensible idea to have your largest trading partner aware and able to use your language and aware of your culture, because you can read books about your culture in your language, and you sort of trusting that they'll treat you fairly? I think that's the dumbest thing I ever heard of. We should line up 100 schoolmen and women from around the United States and say, how come no Chinese? Well, we could go on and on about what isn't taught. In fact, the purpose of institutional schooling was to correct the tremendously advanced educational non-system America had in the 19th century. And your listeners don't have to take my word for that. They need to read Alexis de Tocqueville's Democracy in America, published in several volumes, but by 1835, and he says no country in history, including ancient Greece, has ever been as well educated as this one, and yet we had no systematic schools. Well, that worked fine as long as the ideal of America was that people should have their own independent livelihoods, be entrepreneurial. The minute we got a corporate system, people who thought for themselves and struck out in their own directions became poison to the system. And so institutional schooling, which had never occurred in the history of the human race, that's what people ought to raise their eyebrows about. Suddenly, the drums are being beat for it after the American Civil War, and by 1890, we have the fledgling flexing its muscles. By 1910, we have the police collecting everybody and stuffing them in these schools. So we're dealing with a piece of social engineering designed to make the American young fit the new factory economy, the new corporate economy, which is arranged, as you know, in a ladder system. One person, theoretically at least, knows everything, although from what I see around me today, it doesn't seem that always holds true. You know, the next people are the hands and the assistants and on down to the big mass at the bottom, who do one operation or a very limited number and take orders. So schools are meant to teach reflexive obedience so that the corporate system can work, particularly the factory system, which we hardly have any longer since we gave it away. We're hopelessly out of sync with what the world has become. We are heading at breakneck speed toward what I call an open access world. The internet has changed the face of everything. It's changed the face of science. The connections with even with legitimate experts are easy for anybody to arrange. Information about new developments that wouldn't have been available in your lifetime or mine, except to insiders, are available to everybody. Let me give you an example of that.
Sure.
Last year, there was a marvelous book about the history of the tobacco industry published. Mm-hmm. I can't remember the exact title, but it's as big as a dictionary, and it's packed full of intimate insider memos from tobacco executives to one another. For example, on the deliberate loading of the tobaccos with extra nicotine to produce addiction. Where did the author obtain this information? He says in the preface that he was denied access by every tobacco company to their records. That's not as strange to see why. But he went to the internet and he discovered 40,000 pages of insider documents that had been forced into the public record by lawsuits against tobacco companies, and he wrote his book based on this 40,000 pages of insider records. But they would have been equally accessible to you or me or a bright 10-year-old. The internet has changed everything, but schools are still operating as if we have a factory economy and a ladder-like system of management.
Was that Goodman's book by any chance, Jordan Goodman?
Yes. You've read it, huh?
No, I had snippets of it, but I didn't read the whole thing because
That's
you're right.
It's a lovely, lovely book, but the
big
author admits that, you know, it all came off the internet from court-forced documents, which probably were much more damning than if the tobacco companies had said, sure, look through our archives of, you know, 190 million pages.
So what were you saying, John, to these students in New York City when the police came and kind of shut you down?
Let me tell you, I was invited by a member of the school board to speak at a wealthy, very, very elite-looking public high school about 40 miles north of New York City. It was Highland High School in Hudson, New York, and the parking lot's full of Cadillacs and, you know, Mercedes that the kids are driving. So I'm invited to speak to the graduating senior class. And I'm not by nature, it's just by accident that I'm a troublemaker. I said, how can I be useful to these kids? And then it occurred to me that all of them would have been intimidated by college admissions invisible rules. Mm-hmm. So I thought what I would do is remove the fear by bringing to these graduating seniors the SAT scores and the grade point averages in high school of many prominent living Americans, presidents, corporate CEOs, et cetera, and I think it paralyzed the district superintendent who was visiting that these secrets should come out. For example, that not only Bill Gates, but nobody at the top of the computer business that anyone's ever heard of has a college degree. They all agreed it was a waste of time. So Gates doesn't have one. His partner, Paul Allen, doesn't have one. Steve Jobs doesn't have one. Steve Wozniak didn't have one until recently when he wanted to become an elementary school teacher, and they wouldn't let him do it in California unless he had a teacher degree.
Yeah.
Michael Dell doesn't have one. Larry Ellison doesn't have one. Ted Turner, who gave us the only global television network, CNN, he doesn't have one. I mean, I could go on for the rest of the 2 hours. How come all of this is a deep, dark secret except when somebody does a Sunday supplement human interest story about it? These people don't have college degrees because one of the more interesting bubbles in the American bubble economy is packing people into school. It's a jobs project, and college is a cushy jobs project. You know, if you actually ask, and I mean this as a challenge to you, next time you have a college professor on as a guest.
Sure, and we do that a lot, too.
Say, tell me specifically why you're teaching this. Why is this being taught? You know, if you ask 100 of those people, you'll get a blank stare, usually from all 100 of them. Well, it's just what we do, you know. Every high school kid in the United States has to commit to memory if they want an A average how a bill becomes a law. If you look at the finest text that explains that, you'll say, well, wait a minute, no bill in human history ever became a law that way. Why don't they tell the kids how a bill actually becomes a law?
Right. And, you know, it reminds me of a movie, I can't remember the name, with Rodney Dangerfield. And he was yeah, a guy named Mellon. And that's exactly what he said when he went to his son's college. Back to school, that's it. And he said, you know, teacher, why don't you tell them about how we grease the politicians? That's how it's done. But
lovely.
But you're right, John. It's different in the real world.
Well, you know, one of the things that made me a little bit different as a school teacher is I would tell my kids at the beginning of the year that at any time, as long as they were polite about it, they had a right to ask me, why are you doing this? And if I didn't have a sensible explanation, not necessarily one they would always agree with, but that I hadn't worked it out in my head why I was doing A, B, or C, then they had a perfect right to do something else. And I would support them in doing something else. And I unfortunately, because I was innocent at the beginning of my teaching years, I said, always ask your teachers, but be polite. Say, why are we doing this? Well, that raised a firestorm. I mean, you're doing it to fill time. That's why you're doing it, you dunce.
Hey, John, we're going to take a break, but we're going to come back with you and continue chatting. The next hour, we'll open up phone lines. Everybody wants an opportunity to chat with you as well. John's website is linked up right now at coasttocoastam.com, johntaylorgatto.com, spelled GATTO.com. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Absolutely. With our special guest tonight, John Taylor Gatto. John will be with us this hour, and next hour we'll take calls with him right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast with John Taylor Gatto and your phone calls next hour right here on Coast to Coast AM. How do we fix the problem, John? Seriously, what do we do?
I have a feeling, George, I know the problem is fixable, and here and there around the country, individual families, school teachers, superintendents are fixing the problem. But to do it systematically, I'm afraid it's not in the cards. And let me try to prove that case. Schooling, with all its ancillary occupations, you know, driving the school books from the warehouse to the school, et cetera, is by far and away the largest business in the United States. And it employs the most millions and millions of livelihoods depend on it. We have nothing, nowhere to put these people if you pull the thread and school comes apart, as nearly 3 million homeschoolers have done since 1977 when there were 10,000. I mean, that movement keeps growing geometrically because it's simply easier to learn in that kind of customized environment there. I think what we're probably going to have to do is unthread as much of this as we can without causing chaos, and that seems to be underway right now. But then to use institutional schooling to assist open source learning, which absolutely is the wave of today, let alone the wave of tomorrow, that certified school teaching is a way to make sure that the people who have contact with kids have the same ideas as the boss does. That's what the certification is for, not to protect the children or to provide highly trained, it's almost laughable to say that, highly trained pedagogical assistants. Even the word pedagogy should give the game away, George. It's the Roman term for slave. I mean, why would we have preserved that as the fancy label for the business for thousands of years? Pedagogues are slaves, and that goes from the lowliest rookie teacher to the highest superintendent. Although I must tell you, and I hope this brings a smile to your lips, I was brought into the Upper Peninsula of Michigan last week by a school superintendent, and we sat for 3 days kicking ideas back and forth. And when I left, he said, I'm going straight to the booking part of this business and get myself a teaching program for the fall. That is, he'll remain a superintendent, but he's going to actually have contact. So there are little green shoots everywhere, but there is no system that you can impose from the top down that won't quickly corrupt itself.
You know, John, I think all of us can remember that one special teacher that we had in high school that truly made a difference for us.
Oh, sure.
Everybody.
They're there.
Yeah.
They're out there. But in a funny way, they're saboteurs. They may not think of themselves that way. But by introducing a measure of humanity and by adapting the teaching according to the individual kid, they are sabotaging the system. Even by definition, a system cannot survive customization. It has to be the same for everybody, one right way. This shoe fits. If it doesn't, you're in trouble.
Tell me about our teachers. There are many out there that are trying. Are they getting any support, or are they hitting their heads against the wall?
For the most part, they're hitting their heads against the wall. There's some promise in the this movement of small schools. Unfortunately, what seems to happen is the original pioneers who set up a charter school themselves are wide open to ideas, to customization, to open source learning. But when those people pass on to some different phase of their lives, the schools seem to be invariably almost inherited by hand-picked personnel of the school superintendent, who then impose a kind of school discipline that's more palatable because the place is small, so you're going to have a little more humanization just because of its size. But I don't want to be thoroughly negative about it. That movement has spread and continues to spread, and it offers some promise. The homeschoolers offer a magnificent promise. If you and I wanted to just get down to brass tacks, our country's in desperate trouble, and everyone knows we're not going to dig our way out of it by factory production. The way we got the dominant position in the world we have is through imagination. We once had 90% of all the patents on planet Earth. That was just before the Second World War. After the Second World War, when forced schooling was applied very seriously to everyone, that number of patents started to drop. It's now in the 20s, I think, or 27% from 90%. We're going to have to get back to what the original American Charter of Liberty, freedom, free choice promises us, that it will open opportunities that you can't dream of. But planned opportunities are what sunk the Soviet Union. And let's give them credit. I'm sure they were sincerely using the best rational means to plan the future economy of the Soviet Union. Well, you can't do that. The human mind isn't up to that job.
Here we are in the midst of one of the worst economic situations in decades. And, you know, last week they came out with a report that toughest year ever for college graduates. You just talked a little bit about college.
Oh, the bubble will be revealed, George.
Yeah, I was going to say,
we cannot deliver work for these people who've laid out 100,000 or a quarter of a million and are deeply in debt for the most part when they step out. We can't deliver the work unless, of course, we run the printing press and hand them some paper and say, here, go spend that. That's self-limiting.
What about their hopes, their dreams? They want a better position. They want to get out of school. They want a future. What's out there realistically for them, John?
Well, you know, I think we need to question, and I'm not coming down definitively on this. We need to question whether climbing a ladder and getting more and more money and moving away from your old friends into the suburbs is a correct dream. It doesn't seem to work for the people who've actually got it. Probably works for some of them. It doesn't seem to work for the ones I know. But what we have to get in the position we're in, school set out, one of its tasks was to minimize the inner life, where you live imaginatively and you follow principles rather than pragmatism there. And we succeeded in wiping out, to a very large measure, the idealism that created this country and drove it to wonderful heights of prosperity. Incidentally, the idea was that you wrote your own program, your own ticket, your own marching orders. In fact, Abraham Lincoln, in probably, in my opinion at least, the greatest speech he ever gave, was the Gettysburg Address. In 1859, he spoke to the Wisconsin Agricultural Association, and he said, the British are coming back in here with their stuck-up sons, and they're saying, forget paying any attention at all to the poor in the lower middle classes because they have nothing to offer. You know, they're useless. Use them until they're worn out and throw them away. And Lincoln said, look around you, he said. The American dream is having your own little business, whether you're a seamstress, you know, or an inventor or a small farmer. He said, and 75% of our population has an independent livelihood where they make the terms of their own daily existence. I do think we need to, bit by bit, get back to that, to self-sufficiency, to hard work as the preparation to seize opportunity when it comes there. Not following orders in the hopes that you'll be the one selected to be moved up the corporate ladder. It's a barren existence. It's not one, by the way, that Emperor Marcus Aurelius would recommend.
So you've left teaching. How do you feel about that?
You know, I had such exhilaration when I was teaching because I reached a point where my kids, through acts of sabotage, were teaching me as much as I was teaching them. I made all of New York City and even adjoining states the textbook. I drew the mothers, particularly, sometimes the fathers, into a kind of a cabal, a conspiracy, and we customized the curriculum for each kid who wanted. There were always 10% who wanted to do it the company way, and that was fine. Then they could do it the company way. But the others ventured out, and they produced new knowledge. I know how grandiose that sounds, so give me a chance to give you some examples of that. Because we got 65 million trapped school children who could be doing this. Last year, now this first one is not my kid, but it's somebody's kid, a 13-year-old girl, produced new knowledge and made headlines all over the country, really, front page stories at least. What she did was take what's common knowledge, that fish stocks are declining around the American coast from overfishing. And in particular, she thought it was odd that a fish called red snapper, which was in steep decline, was for sale in unlimited quantities all over Manhattan. So the little bugger took tiny little samples from 42 fish of the red snapper, and she sent it to one of these DNA testing laboratories, and the word came back that 80% of them weren't red snapper. There were some cheaper fish called redfish. Now, imagine, George, what that signifies if virtually all the fish dealers in Manhattan thought they could get away with cheating the people of a few bucks in their pocket who can afford red snapper.
Yeah.
I mean, this is, I think, a society so divided.
Of scammers. Of scammers. Yeah. It really is.
Yeah, and I'm sure they would have been angry, the fish dealers, if you called them on it. But of course, they were called on it by a 13-year-old girl. Let me tell you just a few of the things my own kids did. The single most profitable and successful fundraiser, permanent fundraiser in New York State history is the IS-44 weekend flea market on West 77th Street in Manhattan. Well, that was started by a group of my kids who said, nobody ever uses this playground. I guess people outside of New York City don't know that there's such fear of lawsuits that the playground gets tiny use in New York City. Here was this big piece of expensive real estate. And I said, why don't you take a week off and go research and find out and make a plan for that. And I'll try to push that through the school board. And the kids came up with this idea that they could have a three-sided flea market, one that would bring in local farmers for a green market, one part that would bring in merchants with cut price, you know, socks and undershirts and the rest of this stuff, and the third part would be, because New York City doesn't have garages and lawns, to have a place where parents could set up garage sales, lawn sales, you know, that's that sort of thing. It was instantly successful, packed on the weekends, year-round, generates about $750,000 in pure profit. The school district immediately preempted it from us. We want to divide it equally among the 22 schools in the district. But hey, most of those schools were for black kids or Spanish kids, and you know, you didn't have to waste the money on them. So this flea market was turned over to the two whitest schools in the school district. And if you hear humor in my voice, it's a kind of dark Morden humor.
Right, right. John, you know, would you go into teaching again if you had to do it all over?
You know, I would tell people that there's almost no other way to get maximum responsibility, which is really the key to happiness, to have something real to do. It's the easiest way, and the pay isn't bad. Unfortunately, the temptations are horrifying. The first day I taught, and I've got my right hand raised, may God strike me dead if I'm exaggerating at all, the union boss in the district came in. He said, I'm going to say this to you once, and if you tell anyone, I'll deny I said it. He said, you got a 5-day work week, he said. You give a short answer test every Friday, and now you have a 4-day work week. You prepare the kids for the short answer test on Thursday. Now you have a 3-day work week, and on Monday you pass the test out uncorrected, and you have the kids correct them in class. Now he said, you got a 2-day work week. Okay, he said, that's, you'll never hear that again. And he walked out the door, and suddenly, George, I was confronted with the whole history of my own schooling. That was it.
John, I sometimes wonder if this dumbing down is done on purpose for this reason, and that is, as you said earlier, slaves, control, total control.
Yeah, it is. The major reason, and it was the system was invented first by a whole lot of philosophers. No one could make it work until the early 19th century, when the Prussians, who were a very successful military state in northern Germany, imposed a forced system at bayonet point, and they almost immediately became very wealthy, the fourth wealthiest country in the world, even though it's an extremely poor part of the world. So delegations came from the United States. Horace Mann went over there, from Japan, from all over the world to see how Prussia was doing this forced schooling. And if any of your listeners want a pleasant way to put themselves in touch with this, they want to read, not see the movie, but read the most famous war novel written in the last century, All Quiet on the Western Front, which follows the life of ex-German schoolboys in combat in the First World War, and you see the system of brainwashing at work minute by minute there. So the idea was, and I know you've heard this expression, the idea was to convert human beings, sovereign human beings, into human resources that could be spent by the leadership. Now, if you develop a critical mind in your students, they're certainly going to argue with your plans for them. So you don't want that. The easiest way is not to intimidate them with bayonets, although the Germans did that too, but it's to remove the ability to think critically. It's to teach kids that important books are boring and they don't have to be read. You can read somebody else's paragraph-long summary of what the book's about.
John, we're going to come right back and take phone calls with you next hour on Coast to Coast AM.